Welcome to Writers with Wrinkles, where authors Beth McMullen and Lisa Schmid iron out the wrinkles in writing, publishing, and everything in between, one podcast at a time.
So we've all heard that we shouldn't judge a book by its cover, but do we anyway? And is it important for an aspiring author to develop a platform before they've published even a single word? Plus all that talk about moving the needle, what's that about anyway? Today on Writers with Wrinkles, we answer these questions and so many others. So stay where you are and we will be right back. Hi, friends. Welcome to episode 40. We are very excited to welcome author Lindsay Curry to the podcast today. Lindsay is the author of four spooky middle grade novels, including The Peculiar Incident on Shady Street, Scritch Scratch, What Lives in the Woods, and The Girl in White. While she's never experienced anything truly paranormal, Lindsay enjoys researching her city's forgotten history and learning about the events that shaped the many ghost legends in Chicago. When she's not reading or writing a mystery novel of her own, Lindsay can be found taking long walks with her family, chilling with her dog, or searching the graveyard for her next antagonist. You can visit Lindsay at lindsaycurry.com. So thank you so much for joining us today. We are super excited to have you on, as you can tell.
Thank you. I'm so happy to be here.
And before we jump into the questions that we have on deck for you, you have a new book coming out September 5th titled It Found Us. And can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, absolutely. So It Found Us takes place actually in a suburb of Chicago. So I think a lot of people, it's no secret that I'm kind of into local history, especially forgotten or lost history here in Chicago and the surrounding suburbs. And It Found Us takes place in Forest Park. And really, I think the thing that is so cool about this book, I mean, to me personally, the thing that I enjoyed writing the most was the fact that the main character, Hazel, is a bit of an amateur detective. She's a sleuth, and she really considers herself to be an up-and-coming detective. Her idol is Kate Warren, who is, you know, our supposedly, you know, the first female detective, really. So it's fantastic. And I really enjoyed writing this character because she is so tenacious and she is so methodical. And the other thing is she is kind of fighting an uphill battle because like a lot of tweens in her age group, I think her sleuthing is not really perceived as being a positive thing. Her parents and a lot of the people in her town kind of view her as a pest or a snoop. And she's so tired of not being taken seriously. And she so desperately wants a real mystery, a juicy mystery to fall into her lap. But she doesn't expect it to be as serious as what actually happens. Hazel overhears her older brother, Den, through the wall separating their rooms. She overhears him talking about sneaking out one night to play a game of hide and seek in the local graveyard. And that graveyard, I know, this should send up red flags for all of us. It's like warning, you know, warning lights everywhere. This graveyard has a reputation for being very haunted. Everyone tries to avoid it, especially the kids. There's a creepy little rhyme that goes along with it. But she follows him because one of Hazel's other goals is to have a podcast of her own. She wants to title it What Hazel Knows. And she thinks, well, you know what? Maybe something cool will happen in this graveyard while he's there. And I am going to see it and I'm going to hear it. And it's going to be the first episode of my podcast. So she follows him, not really expecting anything major, but maybe some cool, spooky things. She hides in a bush. And when all of the kids run off to play hide and seek, her brother is the seeker and he finds them. They all start coming back, but one doesn't come back. All of these scary things start happening and Hazel has the biggest, most frightening mystery she's ever faced. And that is what happened to her brother's best friend. And can she actually unravel all of the clues that are happening around her to find him when the local authorities seem to just have thrown their hands up in the air? They have no real leads. So that is It Found Us in a nutshell. There's a lot of cool history, a lot of scary scenes, of course, but as with my other books, there's a lot of themes that are important to me, like family and friendship and bravery and empathy and all of the the heartwarming things I think you don't naturally think of when you think of a horror book.
I saw the cover on Amazon and I literally gasped because it is so creepy. It is so creepy. I was like, I was bowled over by it.
I have to tell you too, I mean, your listeners aren't going to be able to see this because obviously they're going to be hearing and not seeing, but when you all see the cover, the boy on the cover is, I don't know if you can tell, but he is shiny. He's like almost three-dimensional.
Yeah, yeah.
And all of the lightning bolts coming down from the sky are three-dimensional. And then they did the coolest thing on the inside. They put lightning bolts down the spine and they used, instead of their traditional Source Books logo, it's actually inside of a kerosene lantern, which is also on the cover. So I am blown away by the packaging of this book. It's just a beautiful book.
I did a total double take and I just saw the image on Amazon. I'm going to go certainly and go and get one of those books. I encourage everybody to go get one. It is like, you have to see the cover. And now that I know that it's like 3D and sparkly, I'm there for that. That's awesome.
I know. There's such a huge difference when you see a galley or an arc of a book and then you get to see the finished copy. There's always a huge discrepancy in quality. And, you know, those arcs are just not meant to be permanent books. And this book feels like something as a book lover, just the physical book lover, that I would want to have on my shelf regardless. You know, it's just so pretty and it feels so nice.
Yeah, that's great. I'm glad that is happening for you. It does make a difference. I think when you're in a store, especially, and you see it, it catches your eye. Then you pick it up, you read the jacket, and then you're like, yep, this is my next book.
When I saw the cover, it's so funny because Beth texted me the other day and she's like, oh my God, have you seen this cover? It's off the hook, creepy. And I'm like, yes, it is.
I think the thing too is that young readers really like a little bit of scare factor in these covers. This past year has been really interesting because from an author standpoint, I feel like the curtain has been pulled aside a couple times for me where I've gotten to see a little bit more of this process on the other side of things, on the publishing side, and what goes into these covers and why there's so much testing involved. Because I've had a broad spectrum of covers. I think Scritch Scratch was creepy, but pretty and had a very artistic vibe. What Lives in the Woods had a little bit more of a commercial vibe, and it wasn't quite as scary, but was very beautiful. And Girl in White had kind of a cozy mystery vibe, right? I mean, because it does have some scary scenes, but it is kind of a cozy mystery. And I think when I look at all of these covers, the one that has probably the strongest, most intense appeal to me is It Found Us. And I think it's because it's an effective cover. Like, yes, the boy is creepy, but also, like, I don't know, to me, a good cover, and for everyone listening, I'm holding this up because there are these elephants in the background of this cover. There's a lot of things going on in it that make you curious, that make you wonder why, okay, well, why are there elephants on the cover of this horror book when it doesn't say anything about elephants in the blurb, right? And I think that's what they did so well with the cover of It Found Us, was create a scary cover that matches the tone, but also an effective cover that makes you want to read and know more.
I think all the best covers have that invitation to learn more and pique that curiosity. And what I hadn't even noticed the elephants until you pointed them out because of the way they're kind of, you know, in the background, obviously. But right away, I'm like, okay, what's she doing now? Like, I know that there's some local history tied into it and why these elephants are there. And that's something that, and we talked about this on Books on Botox, about your books, is that you do such a great job at looking at your town's history and, you know, finding these obscure things that are really interesting and peeling that back. And we get to peek in behind the curtain with whatever crazy story that you come up with that is so uber spooky and fabulous. So I can hardly wait to.
Thank you.
Well, you know, I'm such a huge fan. So that is, I love your book.
You know, and it's funny, like, I have these conversations at schools all the time, because I won't say that every single book I write is always going to have this huge chunk of history somewhere in it or be rooted in something historical, but it is a personal interest of mine, which is funny because when I was a kid, I really disliked history. It was like my least favorite class. I think I associated it with memorization and wars, and I didn't really think outside the box about exploring what history could mean to me. And even think about what history has been forgotten. Why hasn't it been told? What are we missing? And those are the things that interest me now, because a lot of Chicagoland history, and I suspect anywhere in the world, if you were to do this exact same thing that I do, you would find these wild stories that, I mean, young readers email me all the time and say, is this fictional? Like, did you make this part up? And when they find out that is not one of the parts I made up, their minds are just blown. They're like, wait, that actually happened? And that's the really cool thing about being able to kind of marry these two things, is that I think young readers come in looking for the ghosts and the scares, and I'm going to give them that, but I'm also going to give them a little something on the side that maybe they weren't anticipating.
With that in mind, I think it will invite kids to want to look at their own town's history, see if there's anything spooky or interesting, or just because every town, it doesn't matter where you live, there is something that happened there in its history that's always interesting. A while back, I was participating in like a short story urban legend thing. And I remember just Googling urban legends, and all these crazy stories came up from all across the country that have like weird, they're rooted in deep history, and then it creates that urban legend from it. And so I think it invites kids to seek what is in their own backyard.
I agree 100%. And I think it just gives this, it gives another layer too for the kids and the readers who want to learn or explore beyond the book. You know, I think that's one of the great joys that I've experienced that I never expected, was finding out how many teachers and schools use my books. I think for a long time, horror, especially middle grade horror, was a bit stereotyped, right? I think people were like, oh, you know, kind of looked at a little bit like a fluff something or other, you know, kids just like to be scared. And showing up on state award lists and seeing teachers use my books has been such a wonderful, heartwarming thing, because it shows me that they're seeing these things that I feel passionate about, right? And I'll get pictures of readers in really wild places. Like it's great. Like I had a family email me a while back and say that they were coming into Chicago. I don't even remember where they were coming from, but this was a family trip, right? They were coming in for like 4 days. They were going to get a Cubs game. They were going to, you know, eat at Chicago places. And one of their kids insisted that their stop include Graceland Cemetery. Thank goodness for these parents who said, okay, you want to see these statues, you want to be part of that history, you want to experience that history. And they took them and they sent pictures to me. And that is just absolutely amazing. That it's another opportunity for kids to engage with history and with the story and with characters and with something like this outside of just reading the book.
Well, I'm gonna say that leads us perfectly into our first question. You have built like this amazing, successful media platform. And it's one of the things I noticed, like right away, it caught my attention. I read your first book and, you know, obviously I fell in love with it. And then I was watching you on social media, and I feel like just even with your first book that you kind of had this rock star status about you. And I feel like you were very methodical in building your platform, and you had a plan in place. And I'm curious, like, did you have specific steps? Did you have a goal? Because it really seems like there's a lot of authors out there that are, you know, we're all trying to figure out how to make that moment happen on social media, but you really did it. Like, how do you feel like you know, did you have a plan? How did you go about this?
Oh, well, first of all, thank you. I'm glad that this appears as though it was methodical and something that I...
Please tell me it was.
Worth that. Well, you know, pieces. So I think when I first started out, I'm trying to remember, I think that Twitter was probably one of my first big platforms, honestly. And when I first started, I didn't have any book deals. I didn't have any books coming out. I was in the throes of trying to find an agent. I was getting rejections. And for the most part, when I first started, I was just looking for my people. I was looking for people who I think were going through similar things to what I was going through. I was looking for people to learn from also, because, you know, I can look back now and say, boy, I hope some of the agents I queried don't remember my name, because I sent them things that were atrocious, like that never should have been sent to anybody. They weren't ready. I just didn't have any guidance, you know? And so when I first got on Twitter, I remember just looking for people who has already succeeded, you know, where are they? What did they do? What kinds of content are they posting? Like, what do I find interesting? What is helpful to me? And then when I did get my first break and Peculiar Incident got picked up by Simon & Schuster, I tried to kind of make that switch, right? And that switch was very much, still stay me, still try to give some sort of insight into who I am as a person and not just, you know, the blurb on a book cover, but also start creating content for readers as well. And I think that's the challenging thing about any social media, especially if you're writing middle grade. Our readers really aren't on Twitter. Our readers are, you know, this is not their platform. We're talking to educators and librarians and yes, some adult readers, but you know, for the most part, our readers are on TikTok and other places. So I think it's been a learning and a growing experience for me, honestly. I'm really glad that it comes across as something I carefully crafted, but I think it's just been me trying to figure out what works. And, you know, fake it till you make it is kind of a thing, you know? I mean, I think you have to put yourself out there to some degree and try something and see what sticks and what you feel confident with as well. Like I'm just never going to be the kind of person that's comfortable going online and either sharing a bunch of personal family stuff. I don't share pictures of my kids really anymore because I have enough of following in places that I just don't think they need me leaving their footprint everywhere, or things that aren't me. Yeah, that's always kind of been my approach. And it really is just go with the flow. I find social media to be, it's such a love-hate relationship. I don't know how you guys feel about it, but like there are some days when I'm just so grateful because I've met people like you, right, on social media. Some of my very best writing friends are people I know through social media and have not spent physical time with in a room. So for that reason, I owe a lot to it. But on the other hand, sometimes it's just like such an emotional drain and I want to quit it all.
That is a perfect description of, I think, most people's relationship with social media. You love it, you hate it. It's good for some things. It feels toxic in other ways. But I do like what you said about how you started building out this platform before you had even gotten your first book deal, before you had something that you were trying to get awareness of. And I think that probably contributes to the authenticness with which you come across, because you started as somebody who was just trying to figure out what they liked there, what was interesting, what worked, rather than I'm here to sell this book. So yeah. I think that's an interesting point for people to remember as they try to build out their social media platform.
I think too, like, I'm always watching people who I really appreciate and enjoy seeing on social media, you know, people who make me smile, people who make me learn something or experience something that maybe I haven't before. And you make such a good point. These people are not selling us something. Nobody likes a used car salesman feel. And I think that it's really important to avoid that. There is no way to avoid boosting yourself, nor should we. I mean, publishing, how can I say this in a kind way? Publishing loves to make us try to move the needle as much as we can on our own without the resources that would really help us do that. And I've heard this time and time again from authors. So that gives us very little opportunity to move that needle except through social media. So are you still going to see posts from me like, oh, I have a book coming out in 6 weeks. Boom, here it is. Please consider pre-ordering it. Of course you are, because we don't have very many other avenues to do that, as you guys know. But I try really hard to not make that all that I am on there.
Well, I think you need to have a good mix of promoting and supporting other authors And then, of course, supporting, you know, promoting yourself. Some people are like, oh, I feel so uncomfortable promoting myself or pitching my book. I'm like, no, we're all here to, you know, see that as well. So don't be afraid to do that. But also at the same time, be, you know, promoting other people that you want to get that same feeling in return when it's your turn.
Absolutely. And that's how I build my TBR pile. Is, I mean, honestly, like when I see recommendations on Twitter for something that looks amazing or Instagram or wherever I'm at, we've got all these new ones. I'm like, I don't even know. I feel like I'm leaving little Lindsay corpses in other places because I'll like try something and then fully abandon it and be like, I don't understand this. I don't like this. Never mind. Forget I even tried it. And then there's like this husk of me sitting on some other social media. But that is genuinely how I build my TBR. So I do appreciate it when I see authors putting themselves out there. What do you have coming out? Wait, what have you read lately that's been really, really good? I love seeing that kind of stuff.
I like what you said about moving the needle. I want our listeners to remember that as they go on their journey. Moving the needle as a single author is a very difficult task. So don't beat yourself up over it. It's hard. This actually leads kind of nicely into our next question, which is about school visits, because this is another revenue stream for authors, especially anybody who's writing for teens or younger kids. And you have been very, very visible on the school visit scene, essentially right after your first book came out. And I know a lot of people ask about how to get going with school visits. So if you could walk us through your experience with getting started and how you kind of got to the point where now you're very much in demand all the time. That would be, I think, super helpful to hear about because I know there's a lot of curiosity around school visits.
Yeah, for sure. So I think the thing about school visits that, at least to me, is I know frustrating for a lot of people is that it can be hard to get the word out and get started. I feel like people often feel like they don't have any street cred, and I think the general inclination for a lot of authors is, well, I'm just going to offer to talk anywhere for free anytime. And I just would really, really caution authors against doing that. I very strongly feel, and I do occasionally do free visits, depending on the circumstances, but it is pretty rare because it is work that we're doing and we are valuable. Like our time is valuable. And I just really want authors to recognize that, you know, when you are going to a school, regardless of whether or not you have to travel, you are taking time away from family and deadlines and your own other work in order to do that. And just like you wouldn't, you know, show up at the dentist's office and ask them to fill a cavity for free, you know, we really shouldn't be expected to work for free either. And so I do realize it's hard in the beginning. And so this natural reaction, I think, is to just kind of like fling ourselves out there. But I think it's an overtime thing. So when Peculiar Incident came out, I did about a week of school visits that were completely free, celebrating the launch. So this was with my debut book. I did some of these in conjunction with local bookstores that set them up for me. And then sent me places. And this was back when, with this first book, my publisher was, they were great. They were really kind to me, but I was also a nobody and I was a really small fish in a big pond. So it's not like there was a ton of marketing money being pumped into anything. It was all very grassroots, everything that happened. I sent out emails introducing myself and my book to teachers and librarians in the area. I talked about what my presentations were going to look like and that my overall goal is to get students excited to read and write. It is not to show up at your school to sell my books. Do book sales help me? Of course they do. Do I encourage book sales? Of course I do. But that's not the main point of my presentation. And after doing those, you know, that first week of visits, I think from there, I really learned that what educators value when you come into their school is you being genuine, you interacting with their students, you leaving them with this overall sensation that, hey, this lady is just a normal person who was like standing in line at Starbucks this morning, but she wrote a book and I can also write a book if I want to. And it might be really hard right now. And I may think I suck at this, but I don't, because sometimes she thinks she sucks at this and she still does it, right? I think it's this organic real explanation of what I do, complete with pictures, and then showing them just a different perspective. I mean, I talk a lot about research and how much I love research. And I can tell you right now, when I first say research, their eyes, they already want to glaze over because they're like, research, would rather do anything else, until they realize I am showing them creepy pictures of tombs and crypts and forgotten history and things that happened in my city that are dark but interesting, right? And that's the kind of research I do. I think it's showing this new perspective in an exciting way, and also just being real, you know, with students. I feel like that's what's valued most about my presentations. Now, in terms of where I am now and how many requests I get now, I think a lot of that has had to do with time. Word of mouth, teachers hearing about me from other teachers, other districts will bring me in. I do a lot of things where I go to a district and I will hit 4 or 5 schools in 2 days. The district brings me in to do something. And then also state award lists are huge, because when you are nominated for a state award, you are automatically being exposed to so many more readers and educators than you probably would have on your own. And those things are also, so like I'll be headed to Kansas in October to actually accept my first actual award, which is exciting. And Scritch Scratch actually won the William Allen White Award in Kansas, which is their like children's book award, which is really exciting. But these are things that just have to happen over time, because it's kind of a slow burn, honestly, with middle grade. You know, from the time a book comes out, that you're not on state award list that season. You're not going to get nominated right away. It just requires time and readers. So I know I've been rambling about this, but it's something I really love school visits. I feel super passionately about them. And when I go into them, it is 110% every single time. Like, I just want them to have the experience that I would have wanted to have when I was a kid. I didn't meet any authors. We didn't have this experience at school. And if you had asked me what an author looks like or sounds like, I would not have described anyone that looked or sounded like me. I would have described an older man with a pipe and maybe like some sort of hound and a fireplace. Like, it would have been a very austere thing, definitely not me. So I think just showing them what an author can look and sound like and how they can do that. And even if they don't want to be an author, you don't have to dislike writing. You can struggle with it and still like it. It's okay. And you can be successful at it.
Congratulations on the award. First of all, that is so amazing. Yeah,
I was very happy. That was a really exciting thing. That's the book is the little book that could. I don't really know. It's just like chugging along, doing its thing. And that was a COVID book that came out in 2020. I genuinely thought it was not going to find its readers ever, because we didn't have anything. You know, we didn't have bookstore visits.
Yeah, it was a wasteland. That's funny. My book that came out in COVID has done surprisingly well too, and I had written it off. I just wrote it off because I didn't have an opportunity to talk about it anywhere at all.
You know, they just sat and waited for their moment, you know?
Yes. I really like what you said about how it is a bit of a slow burn. You start somewhere and don't expect things to grow exponentially overnight. But if you are consistent and you show up and you stay on target and you stay focused, then you can build out this reputation for being a great presenter and a great addition to the classroom. So I think that's also a great thing to keep in mind. I like that a lot.
And I think that you did a good job about using your social media to highlight your school visits. And I think that helped tremendously, because there was just this air of excitement about you in school visits. I would see things and it was like you're a rock star showing up to these schools. And I think when other teachers saw that and other librarians and educators would see that on social media, they're like, yeah, I want some of that.
That was orchestrated. So when you talk about, you know, Lindsay, what did you do that was methodical or planned out? I will tell you very little except for that. And the whole rationale behind, so first of all, I will back up for a second and say this. When I go to school visits, one of the first things I do once I've booked a school is talk to them about ways to prepare for my visit, because, you know, again, it comes back to this concept of moving the needle, right? I can go into a school with as much energy and excitement as I possibly can, but if they're not prepared for me, if they don't know who I am, if they, you know, I'm not saying they have to have read any of my books, but a little hype goes a long way. So if these educators have put some, you know, hype into it, I mean, I have, and it doesn't have to be things like this, but I have shown up to, I showed up to a school this past year where my parking spot they had reserved for me was a graveyard. I had to move tombs, yeah, to pull it in. There were cobwebs. It was incredible. Like I've walked into haunted houses. I've walked into, and those are things the kids participated in terms of preparing for my visit. So they were so stoked by the time I arrived. And then getting there, I always ask what I am and I'm not able to film. And this is really important for authors because in some cases there are certain students that, you know, cannot be, you know, photographed. And so I tend to ask that right away so that I know, can I pan across? What kind of thing can I do to show this school visit in an exciting way? Because every single time I visit a school, I make them a video for their school. And I post that on social media. So I'll be like showing my entrance. I'll show all the cool things. I'll show the crowd. I'll show little bits of their school signage and stuff like that. And that's exciting for them too. And it gives them a way to connect with me after the visit. Because if I'm going to a school where I had five schools in Arkansas at the end of this last school year, and I saw about 600 students in each school at one time, which means my opportunity to interact with students individually was pretty minimal. You know, this was a huge auditorium with a lot of bodies in it, and we had so much fun and there was tons of energy, but it's not like I could talk to a ton of kids, and that's something that means a lot to me. So having that connection with them after where they can find me after and see their school video, maybe even make out a little blob of a face that could be them as I quickly pan over, and then they can comment and say, you were at my school. It was really fun. It was a great day. Means a lot to them also. So I do think, you know, like you point out, it is helpful because other schools can see the energy and the excitement. But it's also a way for the students who were there to have that little bit of a connection after I'm gone.
That's a brilliant tip. That was actually going to be one of our next questions is what is good advice for a newbie author or any author that's looking to build their side revenue as far as doing school visits. And just what you just said about creating that video, because it keeps the energy and the excitement going long after you're gone. It's always going to be there.
Yeah.
So that's a great tip.
I think too, the way I look at school visits. So, you know, and this is just me, but honestly, I look at them like you want to leave knowing that you created a memory, right? You want to know that when you leave, they had a really fun day. They walked away looking at something a little bit differently than they ever had before. Maybe they're going to be excited to pick up a book. Maybe they're going to be excited to try writing. The number of young readers that email me and say, I am writing my own story now, is staggering. And it's really, really exciting because some of these kids will flat out say, because you know, they are very straightforward. I hated writing. I hated reading. I didn't want to read your book. And then you came to the school and something changed. And I think that's pretty magical, honestly. I know that little Lindsay would have really appreciated that. And I don't think I would have waited so long to try to write for a career. I mean, I think there's a lot of fear surrounding writing and sharing your writing with other people. And we associate having trouble with something or struggling with something with meaning that we're bad at it. And until someone comes in and says, actually, no, I really struggle with it. And this is my job. I'm supposed to be good at this. You don't really make that connection.
And those are life lessons across anything that they decide to pursue, that you are going to hit the wall and how do you get through it or around it or over it or whatever it is that you're going to do. But those are, I think that is probably appreciated by the schools you visit too, that this is a message across anything. You're not all going to grow up to be writers, but you are going to, everyone's going to meet a challenge. How do you deal with it?
Yeah.
That's really great. I love that. We're going to switch gears a little bit here So you have many books on deck. We talked a little bit about your forthcoming one that will be out September 5th at the top of the show. But what is your, because you're basically doing one every year, what is your process for drafting, creating, plotting, editing? What keeps you, do you have a methodical approach to it that keeps you on track because you are producing quite a bit?
Okay. So you will find in my writing life, I'm not very good at plotting or being methodical about anything. I don't plot my books, my stories, and I they're harder to write because of it. But I just know I don't work well when I do plot things. I've tried it and I would love to be a plotter. When I see pictures of people with these like cork boards and all these post-it notes, I immediately feel like a sham. Like I am not doing this writing thing correctly because I don't have any of that. And I don't use anything like that. And it's so appealing, right? To have this, everything all organized, but in the broader scope, in terms of getting things done, because I do have, so It Founders comes out in September. So towards the end of the year, but then I have another book coming out right away in April. So less than a year apart for the first time this year. And for me, it's just, I think a big part of it is that I'm very, very type A as a person. And you would think that makes me plot, but really what it makes me do is just not want to ever be behind. So I tend to work ahead all the time. I'm always thinking about the next thing. I don't miss deadlines because I'm so paranoid about deadlines. I generally have things done a month before they're due so that I have plenty of time to let it settle and think. And I am lucky because I am in a position where two of my three kids are in college. So I'm not chasing around a toddler or anything like that. And this is my full-time job. So I'm kind of, you know, these are things that not everyone has and can say, right? So a lot of us are juggling 9-to-5 jobs and writing at night, or writing like I was when I was first starting out when my kids were little and I didn't know what I wanted to write, but I wanted to write writing when they went to sleep at night or before they were awake in the morning. And so I think it's about finding what works for you. You know, for me, it's just one thing at a time. I like to check things off the list and try not to get panicky about them. This has been a really interesting time frame because for the first time, I have books coming out with multiple publishers and some of these deadlines are overlapping, and that's new for me. It used to be one book a year, and then it was, you know, very delineated timeframes related to that book. You know, once I turned it in, I had a little breathing time, right? I could focus on whatever the marketing was for the next book for a little bit and then come back and do the copy edits and then take that break about, you know, and now it's been very much, I'm actually drafting this summer because I have a book due on September 1, but also doing copy edits for the book that is coming out in April of 2024. So it's been a little bit more juggling, but it's what we all want, right? You know, we want contracts, we want to be working. So it's just kind of been a see what works for me situation.
That is actually really good advice on many levels, that I too experience the corkboard jealousy whenever I see somebody with their wall of post-it notes. The multicolored post-it notes make me want to weep. I've Yep. tried to plot. It is a disaster. I put all this time and energy into a plot that I write three paragraphs and the plot is ditched. I've moved on to something else. It just, I'm exactly with you. It needs to develop as it develops. And that's, I think that once you have accepted that about yourself and you're not pushing to try and be a different kind of writer, then, as you said, you figure out your process and what works yeah. for you. And that is very individual. So I think that's yeah. important to remember when you're trying, don't try to be somebody else. Your process is your process. And however that works for you, if you get the book done, then it's a success.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I think every single book is a little bit of a learning process. You know, I think your mental state is a little different with every book. And that, for me, really impacts how I write. I mean, the book that I've been working on this summer, I really did not anticipate the sensation that I've had when I was working on it and how hard it would be, because it sold, these two books sold to a different publisher, different editor. And I've, my past, you know, four books have been with source books and the same editor, and you get very comfortable, right? You know what they like, you know what they want. They know you, they know what you're capable of. So even if you miss the mark on something, you know that they know you can hit that mark. And there's a certain amount of confidence that comes with that. And then when you switch and you're writing for someone new, there is, you know, certainly this new level of awareness of, I don't want to let this person down. You know, I don't want to let this new imprint down. They're expecting XYZ from me. And I, you know, that has been in my head a lot more than has ever been in my head writing any book this summer. It's been really kind of hard for me to put that sensation aside.
Yeah, you're trying to prove yourself again. And I mean, I feel like every book you're trying to prove yourself again. Yeah. It never gets any easier. I'd done a couple of adult books at the beginning of my writing career. I did 7 middle grade books, and now I'm returning to adult, and I'm struggling with a lot of the same stuff where I just doubt myself constantly. I can't do this. I haven't done this in a decade. I don't know what I'm doing. You know, that I think it's turning off that voice or putting it in a box or telling it to, you know, be quiet is also a challenge.
Well, it's funny too. You know, people will say things that they 100% mean as a compliment, right? Like, you know, if I am struggling, like I, you know, struggled a bit this summer working on this book, and, you know, I set it aside and I told my husband, I kind of feel like I'm freaking out a little bit. Like I'm second guessing everything I'm doing. And he said, you know what you're doing. You know how to write a good mystery. You know what you're doing. And that was 100% meant to be a compliment, but that's one of those things that you then start thinking, do I really? You're way more confident than me, because I feel like I'm trying to do this all over again for the first time. I mean, I know all of us want every book to be better than the last, you know, so we're going to push hard every single book and we're going to put that pressure on. But I do think that's what's something is kind of unique about our profession in particular, is that it's so creative. And you have to be in a certain mindset. You know, your mind really messes with you when you're writing. It's a very mental thing.
That is a great note for us to wrap up on, that, you know, there are going to be challenges. There are many challenges, but you can overcome them if you just stay calm and don't freak out. You can freak out a little, but don't freak out totally. Maybe that's the message.
Little freak outs. You can have the mini baby freak outs. You just have to bring yourself back. You have to come back.
Right. Baby freak outs are fine. Yeah. Major life consuming freak outs, try to avoid those at all.
Yes. Yeah. You can. We'll get that put on some t-shirts.
Absolutely. We're going to make a fortune. So Lindsay, thank you so much. This has been chock full of so much information and so many insights that I know that our listeners are going to be very excited to tune in for. This was a great conversation. So thank you for making time for us.
Thank you. It was really fun.
And thank you, listeners, for tuning in. We have added many new listeners recently. So a shout out to all of you. We are thrilled to have you along for the ride. And we will see you again next week, August 14th, with a brand new deep dive episode. So be sure to join us for that. And until then, happy reading, writing, and listening.
Thanks so much for tuning in to this episode of Writers with Wrinkles. If you're enjoying the show, please feel free to rate, subscribe, and leave a review wherever you listen to your podcasts. This helps others find the show, and we greatly appreciate it. Thanks again for tuning in, and we'll catch you in the next episode.